Hello, I'm Katie Derham. Welcome to Expect Better, a new podcast series from Coutts, which looks at the thrills and spills of life through a wealth lens. So far in this series, we've tackled the hot topics of the F word, family, and talking money with kids, how best to donate your money for the greater good, as well as how to deal with life's curveballs, such as ill health. Today, we're going to turn our attention to the fruits of your labour and making work work for you. And I'm delighted to welcome the serial entrepreneur, Sat Virk. He first made his name in retail and then in healthcare and is now exploring a variety of green issues and community initiatives. We're going to be talking to him about that journey, what being an entrepreneur means for him. Also joining us is Hannah Buxton, Managing Director in the Coutts private office. But before we start, I've got a question for both of you. In fact, I'm asking every guest in this series this question as an icebreaker, if you like, which is, in 10 words or less, what does wealth mean to you? So, Sat, over to you first.
In 10 words or less, I think to me it means choices, be they good or bad.
Hannah, how about you?
When I think about wealth, I think about opportunity and I also think about responsibility. And I guess that isn't just for clients themselves, but also their families in whatever view that takes, the communities they work in and the world at large.
Thank you very much, both of you. That sets us up very nicely for the chat to come. But Sat, I'm going to turn to you first. Tell us a bit about where you started and what businesses you were in when you did so well.
Well, it wasn't an aim to do well. That's the first thing. The business was almost born out of being bored in a normal 9-to-5 job, as people would say. I was born in Derby in 1967. My parents are from India. I've got two older siblings. And I suppose culturally, I come from an inner city area in Derby. Went to Liverpool, did computer studies, actually met the fellow that I started off the successful business in healthcare with at Liverpool Poly. After that, I eventually ended up at Asda, who have a head office in Leeds. It was my social life at work that was more important to me than work. Playing football, live for the weekend, that type of thing. I moved from Asda to another retail place that just dealt with software. And when I was about 32, I think I was then, I also got the fellow that I met at Poly a job at my current place. And he was something called a software architect, which is a fancy name for somebody who's really into making computers do the right thing for other people. And we used to commute about 6 miles from still where I live now into Leeds. And it was about an hour commute on a busy day. Unfortunately, somebody threw themselves off a bridge in Leeds and the whole of the Leeds city centre came to a standstill. So we just pulled up in the car, went to the pub. And I said to this guy that I couldn't see myself doing the next thing in management, which was project management. I just didn't find it interesting and I couldn't see why I would do this thing for the next 10, 15, 20 years when I didn't really like it. And at that stage, I think I had 3 kids at that stage. This guy was married to a GP and he'd said that he'd seen the GP's software and he didn't think it was any good and he could write something a lot better, except he didn't know how to get it out there, basically. And I just thought, do you know what? I don't really know how to do that, but it sounds more fun than what I'm doing now. We could have a go at it. That was in 1998, and that's how we started. And for the next 2 years, or a year and a half, we went round the country pretending to be a company called the Phoenix Partnership. We happened to land in a good place at Bradford Health Authority, and we persuaded them we were a bona fide company, and they had something called a health action zone for diabetes because the diabetes is quite prevalent in Bradford. And they wanted a piece of software writing, which was technically advanced piece of software in terms of how things worked. We'd know it today as cloud computing, as in, you know, your emails are stored in the ether somewhere. And we basically got a £40,000 contract and jacked our jobs in. Off we went, and the next 6 years without money was a proper roller coaster ride, and it was fun. But in hindsight, if you said to me, you're 3 kids, you were on about 28 grand a year, and you had £40,000, and which was going to last you basically 3 months because we persuaded 3 other people from the same company to resign as well and start this new company with us, it was madness. Would I do it again? No. There was just something at that time, at that particular time, that made it seem fun and life was worth living again just for the buzz of it.
It also happened to do really well, didn't it? I mean, you hit on something with TPP, isn't it, your company, with that particular bit of software, didn't you?
You're right, it was the software. The concept wasn't new. GPs had computers in the surgeries, but it was the nature of being able to share a GP record from one surgery to the out-of-hour centre or to another surgery to the hospital. And the good thing about it was once it bought into that idea, the other services all sort of had to buy into it as well for the whole thing to work. So it mushroomed a little bit. And then we were lucky at about 2006-07, something came along called the National Programme for IT, which was to split the country into five regions, and they basically wanted to computerise the whole thing. And we weren't in the frame, but because we existed, we had to be phased out slowly. So we were able to sign a contract with the knowledge that we were going to be replaced. But that enabled us to sign a contract that said, well, we've got 4 years, so you've got to make it worth our while. So they started to give us practices to put on our system in the interim. But what we figured was, you know what, the thing we've done is quite hard. I don't think these consultancies are going to be able to do it. And they weren't able to do it. From the interim solution, we became the solution and we became really big, almost overnight. But we managed to keep the company small and stick to what we did, which was software. But I've told Hannah in the past, it almost, when the money started coming in, it became almost boring and corporate and less exciting and predictable.
So when you left TPP, sort of roughly how big was it, just for people listening who are interested in your business story, if you like?
So in terms of company size, we were probably about 110 people, something like that. And today there's probably 200 people. It's got a huge turnover of staff. But our number that we turned over, something like 25 million, but we made a profit of about 13. And that was the thing that made people all go, you what? Because turnover never really meant anything to me. It was that bottom line. How are you making so much profit? And it was because we were efficient in what we did. So it was big, and we were probably the second biggest GP supplier when I finished, just about, and quite close to being the number one.
Hannah Buxton, can I bring you in at this point? Because it's so interesting hearing from Sat and his story and his refreshing views on being an entrepreneur. I mean, but Hannah, you work with clients up and down the UK. Is Sat's story familiar to you, or is every entrepreneur different?
I mean, I think every entrepreneur is different, but there are definitely themes. I mean, some of what Sat was talking about, the passion, the seizing the moment, there's often a moment where it's, you know, am I going to do it, am I not? But the entrepreneur will always kind of say that that's what they're going to do. And it's because they have a vision of it, making it better. So making a product better or just doing it better. And the knock-on impacts they often quite enjoy. I mean, Sat talked about some of the measurements that they look at in terms of how many people they employ or being able to build a business that's successful in the local community and actually, you know, support jobs locally and things like that, which are really important to them. So I think there are things like that that are similar. But I think all of the stories I hear are completely different and always amazing to hear when you hear this roller coaster that people go through of how they've got to today. There's always some great, interesting stories that are in there.
Are there any common traits, do you think?
I think the main common traits are there's always an ability to take a risk. You know, there's always that moment that you're going to go in and resign or from the steady job or, you know, take that opportunity. And as I say, the passion is there, whether it's there for forever or whether it's there for a particular period and a something that's there. But there's always a passion for what they're doing.
I mean, Sat, do you still have an interest in that business now?
No, zero. I sold all my shares to the other guy.
Did you have other projects going on during that time to keep your attention?
Yeah, I spent time in Eritrea because we were doing charitable work for something called the John Holmes Educational Trust for Eritrea. It didn't come from me. It came from a different person who's at Leeds University. But my wife got involved in there because she stopped teaching after our fourth child So in a sense, the wealth has enabled us to do something that she finds interesting, and I found interesting, and that support spawned another thing we're doing in Uganda as well, based around education for girls and period poverty and all this sort of stuff. So it enabled us to do other things. And from about 2017, I'd say, when eventually we shut the door behind TPP, I was able to think less and less and less about TPP and just concentrate on what's actually going on in the present. Kids are growing up, their lives are going on. There's a whole chunk of stuff to come, which is nothing to do with business.
I mean, it's really interesting hearing you talk about your business and your experience of your business, because it's quite an unconventional story in many respects. You know, I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs over the years, and they've perhaps had a more of a plan, if you like, whereas you seem to have sort of happened upon good fortune, good ideas, good people, bad people, you know, and it's been quite unpredictable, and your attitude to it has been quite or fluid, should we say? Is that fair? You know, I mean, is there a way you could define, I guess, the secret of your success, if you like, or is there a tip that you give to somebody for how to do well in business from what you've learned?
I think it's that last bit where you say something like, how to do well in business. There's so many implications in that, because the first implication almost is how to do well financially in business, which is a fair one, because if you can't do well financially, then you can't do your business. And then it gets to, what do you mean by financially well? And somebody would probably row back from that and go, as long as I'm happy to do my business, I'll be happy. So the tip is not to do something you don't like doing, because you're never going to enjoy it. The reason we were successful at TPP was I could talk about it all bloody day. I could think about it all day. The only time I never really, and not in a chore way, not in a, oh God, I've got to spend 3 hours thinking about this or the other. I just liked it. It was just something that was, it was me. The results mattered to me, because they were the be all and end all. If we didn't get the result, I couldn't pay the wages. It was exciting. There's family photos of me pushing a pram in the Horsforth Park with a dog like that, because I'm on the phone or I'm on the text. But I loved it. I loved it. So the tip would be, if you like doing something and it happens to be a business, you'll enjoy it regardless. And if it happens to make a load of money at the end of the day, that's great as well. If you want to do business because you want a Ferrari, then odds tell you you're going to be disappointed. You just are. You know, those are the odds. You've got much better chance of finding something like you like doing day to day. You will be more fulfilled than if you get into a Lamborghini. Because I've got into a Lamborghini, it was all right.
That's my quote of the day so far. I've got to be honest with you. I have to say, actually, that last bit when you were talking about how you had the phone and the buggy and you were loving what you do, suddenly you then sounded, I could see where the passion came from, actually. Then I could hear it. I mean, Sat, you've obviously got a very sort of sensible and level-headed view to acquisition and stuff and consumption, if you like. But do you worry about your money working for you now? I mean, you've got it sitting there in the bank. You know, how does it work for you now? Do you rely on investments, or do you want to put it into new projects? What's it doing?
Coutts invested. So we went through a process of Coutts trying to explain to me what risk averse was. How risk averse was I? And I remember saying that, I've no idea. Shouldn't you be asking, do you want your 20 million quid to become 40 million quid next year? And if I said yes, then you can make the decision and go, well, you're nuts for one, right? You know, you're a huge risk taker. If I was to say, not really, as long as it's worth 20 million pound next year, I'm happy with that, then, you know, I'm low risk. So they take those questions, they come up with your risk profile, and they decide what investments you want to invest in. And from what I understand, government bonds, that type of stuff, you know, the less risky stuff, we're happy. The big thing for myself and Sean was that the investments were going into things that we agree with. So green initiatives, no armaments, every company's looked into, no tobacco industry, anything that you're not against our sort of core beliefs. So, you know, like I would happily lose, not happily, but if somebody said, want to do a big risky investment, if it was a green thing, I might go and do it. But I wouldn't do it just in something else that was to do with, you know, anything that was just consumerism just for the sake of making £1 million. So they look at your profile, they look at all the companies that you're investing in, and it's left there, basically. I don't really think about it.
And you have, though, made a direct investment and set up this green shop, haven't you, in Leeds? So tell us just briefly what that's all about.
The reason that the green shop came about was the kids are really interested in, you know, using less plastic. But Sian was she was volunteering at a place called Seagulls in Leeds, which recycled paint. And they've got a refill shop, but it's in an awful location. It's off the main road. You can't actually walk into it. So I was sat outside a coffee shop on our main street, and the coffee shop opposite was basically to let. And I thought that would make a really good refill shop. Something to do. Let's do it. And I've really enjoyed from getting the lease in last December to building it. Cost, what somebody else would say, is a small fortune. And if you're saying I'm an entrepreneur, not in this case, you know, there's no way I would ever make any money on this shop. You know, it's cost me, I could have done it for a third of the cost. But what I said was, if I'm going to do it, I want to have a bit of enjoyment. I want it to give it like a London look and feel. I don't want it to be pile it high and sell it cheap. The food itself and the goods are very competitive. It's pointless making a fancy shop and then the local people not being able to afford to shop in it. So it's all organic, which we like. Half the family here is vegetarian, so it's mostly organic food, no meat, a lot of vegan stuff. And it was really, really enjoyable doing it, watching the build process, dealing with contractors, and eventually getting it open, even during this pandemic. It's been really, really interesting.
And I understand your children are involved in it as well, aren't they?
Yeah, Lowry, she's the assistant manager. She's good. I told her before I would sack her if she wasn't, and what her first job was to make sure she got in on time. But what I found difficult was actually letting the shop go. It might sound daft, but I loved it. And it's taken me a few weeks just to stop going there every day and seeing how it's going.
I mean, Hannah, just going back to what Sat was saying about wanting you to invest his money in sectors and areas and causes that he and Sian believed in. I mean, are you finding that a lot of your clients are now wanting you to follow a more green agenda?
I think there's a lot more interest in it at the moment. I mean, Coutts started investing sort of ethically or with those kind of screens in 2010, but very much responding to clients saying, this is what I want to do, and then us doing something individually for those clients. I think when we sort of got to 2016, we as a business made the decision that actually clients don't need to sit there and say, well, I need to make a decision over whether I should be investing ethically or I shouldn't be because I want to make money. But actually the two are much more closely linked. So investing for the long term and investing responsibly are absolutely interlinked. And so across all of our investment propositions, we now have ESG screening because we feel that that actually fits alongside what our clients are doing and what our clients need us to do because of these long timelines that we often talk about. And I think there's a lot more interest in it now. So we're seeing clients asking, what does that mean? And what are you proactively doing? And we launched our first sustainability report this year, which has been really fantastic in unlocking and opening the door to some of that. So talking about some of the reductions in carbon emissions that we're targeting within the portfolio and really saying that actually our clients want us to be responsible with their wealth as well and make change with their wealth in the ways that Sat is doing in order to protect the world for the future that they're also bringing their children and the families and things that they care about into.
I mean, on a more general level, do you feel that clients' attitudes to wealth are changing a lot at the moment?
I don't think the attitudes to wealth massively change. I think what people are doing has probably been the same in terms of the things that they really care about. I think their accessibility to be able to make the impact and see the impact is much greater. And I think our ability to talk with future generations and actually, you know, I mean, I do some meetings now with families and we've got three generations sitting around a table talking about charitable foundations and what they're going to do with those funds. And they're making those decisions together. And that's a really incredible thing to do. So I think there's a lot more, because we live longer and because people are just more open and communicative, I think those things are changing. I think a lot of the basics of, I just want to make sure my family are well and cared for and looked after. And that, you know, the, as I say, the causes of what I'm interested in and the communities I work in, and I want to make sure that they're looked after. Those probably haven't changed dramatically. Just how we do it and how we might think about it has changed a bit.
In these podcasts, we are talking about wealth. So, Sat, I was really interested when you said that when the money started coming into TPP, that's when it got boring and it got a bit corporate and you didn't enjoy it so much. But I've got to ask you, did you like having money, though?
Yes, I did, yeah. I still do. I had the opposite feeling when the company finished and there was suddenly, you got a lump sum. That felt uncomfortable because then it was like, I've got this load of money now, which I'm just going to chip away at. It's not a tap that's flowing anymore. It's just a bucket. And that felt uncomfortable. But in terms of, did I enjoy having money? Yeah, because it takes lots of simple stresses away. Like I remember when I was at Asda, ringing the bank up and asking for an overdraft. I said, and I used to make all sorts of excuses up to try and get £200. I was going, all right, I just need £200 till the end of the month. And it's because what Asda have done is they've moved the way they're paying people from the beginning of the month to the middle of the month. I don't know why they've done it. So everything's out of it. And this bloke listened to me from the NatWest in Liverpool for a good 5 minutes. And he went, I think your problem is, and then he read out a load of statement lines on my thing. It was like pizza, something else I bought, something else. And it was like, yeah. And the thing was, Sean was exactly the same as me. We lived on credit and we just moved one credit to another credit to another credit, amalgamated it. So the simple thing about money, the very, very best thing about it is those little stresses that for everybody else will add up. Don't add up for us. So it's the stress that's taken away. And I can see it in my friends. And sometimes I think, oh, you know, somebody's stressed because something's happened and it's like 600 quid. And I feel like going, oh, do you need 600 pounds? Or do you need so-and-so? Do you need... And we obviously give quite a bit of money to friends and family. But even that can slightly be problematic or stressful because you don't know what they're saying to each other. There's an equitable thing around that goes, you know, we went through this years back when we first got the money. We're like, what are we going to do with it? Or could people pay people's mortgage off, et cetera, et cetera? But different people have different mortgages. It's difficult. But generally, I'd be lying if I said, yeah, wealth makes a big difference to the stress of life.
And it sounds like your attitude has changed a bit then over the years from being kind of, you know, excited by it, worried about it, stressed by it, and now it's kind of just like, well, quite grateful and quite chilled about it, really.
There was a point back in about, this was before we exited the company, where we could afford a big house, or bigger house. So we lived with myself and Sean, four kids, two of which shared a bedroom and a dog in a terraced house just up the road here. And with a yard, and it was a big blooming dog. So the only place we could actually go out was to the park. And there was a point where we had the money, and it was like, do we stay in Horsforth where we live, or do we go where everybody else goes with a big house, which is Ilkley, up the A65? And we drove to Ilkley, and we looked at the houses, and I think we both said at the same time, we just don't know anybody here. And Larry was the oldest was at school then, and I just thought, I'd have hated moving when I was her age, having made all friends, and all Sean's friends were through NCT and all this. And we just thought, no, we just want to stay here. And we just bought a house around the corner, basically, and we lived in a small little estate. I think Hannah's been here, but... So, and I think that probably rubs off, in hindsight, to the kids.
Hannah, in your experience, when clients come to you, as Sat will have done, when all that money landed in his bank account after he sold his shares. Typically, what do they ask for your help with?
I think when most clients come to us, their initial ask is almost, what do I do with the money? How do I invest the money? So it's a very sort of one-dimensional ask usually at that stage because it's brand new. They've finished something that they know the ins and outs of completely. And now it's a whole new world with something that seems straightforward, but isn't something that they're particularly familiar with. In reality, what we tend to do is then start to spend just some time talking about what the possibilities are going forward and what it can look like. And actually getting people to take a bit of time to invest and not rush things, because actually there's a, you know, the questions we ask, there are whole plans that we're thinking about, and we're thinking forward 20, 30, 40 years sometimes, versus the person that's sitting in front of you who at the time is just thinking, you know, 3 to 6 months, potentially, maybe a little bit longer, but it's a really different place to be.
I mean, and generally, is it a kind of a 50-50 split between, isn't it fantastic, I've got all this money, but also, isn't it unbelievably stressful? I don't really know what to do with it.
I think initially that could be there. And I think a lot of the things that Sat's talked about already in touching on, you know, who do you help and who do you not help and how do you help them and what do you do and what don't you do and how quickly should I do that and how do we structure it? And people get very worried about, you know, I mean, now you can virtually Google anyone's names and people can see what their parents' business was sold for and their friends can see what that business was sold for. And that can be quite a difficult place to be. So it can be, yes, as stressful as it can be amazing opportunity.
And Sat, as a final thought, if a friend of yours turned around to you tomorrow and said, actually, you know what, I've come into a massive amount of money overnight, what advice would you give them?
It would actually be probably to actually talk to somebody like Coots who used to it, because in every other sphere of life, if you got something, you would want to talk to somebody who'd got it. That's the reason they would be talking to me. You're talking to somebody with experience. What I would advise them, I wouldn't advise them, I would just tell them what happened to me. And if they wanted to take little bits and bats of anything that's relevant to them, fair enough. I was told ages ago, it's like you don't know how to spend your money. By somebody who didn't have any money, so that was okay. But, you know, that person would go, oh, why haven't you got this? Why haven't you bought that? Why haven't you got... If I was you, I'd have had a swimming pool and all that sort of business. So a lot of it's just... There's no really telling people. They're not really going to listen to you. They're going to do whatever they're going to do at the end of the day. But I think when people are asking for advice, they're asking probably the same thing you asked right at the beginning. Just tell me about what's happened to you. And if they want to take anything away from that, they can do. And if they don't, they don't.
And Hannah is looking expectantly right now at us both, Sat, because obviously what you'd then say is go and talk to your financial advisor.
So this is where somebody will say, is there anything in it for me? No.
Hey, listen, it's great to speak to both of you. Thank you very much. And Sat, listen, thanks so much for being so candid and honest about your experience. And as I say, wonderful to hear the details of your story. Hannah, thanks for all your advice as well.
Thanks very much.
That's serial entrepreneur Sat Virk and Hannah Buxton, a managing director in the Coutts private office. And that was the penultimate episode of Expect Better. Please do rate and review, and while you're there, why not go back and listen to any episodes you may have missed in this series? Plus, if you'd like any more information on any of the topics covered today, you can email investmentqueries@coutts.com. And as always, the Coutts.com homepage has a whole host of information about financial planning, investments, and banking. In the final episode of this series, rather aptly, we're looking to the future with Jeff Marsh, who helps coach the next generation of wealth owners, commonly referred to as Next Gen. We'll explore what makes them tick, what makes them different, and what they need to focus on above all else.
We see probably more experiences of people getting it wrong than right, historically. I mean, there are whole books written about the Ford family, the Adidas family, the Gucci family, the IBM family, about how they didn't get it right.
Do join us then.